Hi everybody, it's Toby Miller here, and this is the Cultural Studies podcast. As always, you can follow my adventures or misadventures or incredibly boring monocultural life with the evil podcat Rosie at tobymiller.org. But much more importantly than all of that, I'm very pleased to be here today in Barcelona in the Hotel Turin, where he's staying, with my friend and colleague and somebody I've admired for more than the decade we've known one another, but whom I admire more and more each time I hear him speak, which I did today. And it is none other than Professor Nicholas Cooldrey. Hello, Nick. How are you?
I'm fine. And it's great to be talking with you.
Well, I wondered if we could start with, in a sense, where we are at, which is we both managed to stay awake through your postprandial keynote at this conference on what would life be like without the media. And actually, seriously, folks, it was fantastic. And I gather from what you were saying that it's part of a forthcoming book.
That's right. This was the first unreleased, unedited cutting from the book I've just finished in the version for reviewers for Polity. And the book's going to come out mid-next year, and it's going to be called, the slightly grandiose, I have to admit, title, Media Society World Social Theory.
So this is going to go in a capsule.
In a capsule. You know,
flying
sent
out
across
for future
the universe. But the subtitle.
This is like Nicholas Cooldrey at age 11, right? Where
that's
his address said,
that's
in a Middlesex,
right.
Earth, Britain.
You've got it.
Galaxy.
But I have to give you the more sobering subtitle, which is Social Theory and Digital Media Practice.
Right.
And the book is started off as an attempt, a contract to write a book about media and society, drawing some of my thinking. Theory about ritual and other things in about 2005. And what happened basically was that when I started to get to work on the book in around 2007, the wave of Web 2.0, Web 3.0 was hitting. It became clear that what media were, where they were, who media were, how media effects could be thought about was changing radically.
Mm.
And I needed to step back from it. And then diverted to write the book on Why Voice Matters, which came out last year, which was much more of a political intervention. So I only got back to this in 2010, really, and this year. And this current book is an attempt, really, to think of the implications for my previous work on media rituals, reality, media, media power generally, of the whole digital revolution. Does it fundamentally change the starting points in a way that my early approach makes no sense anymore and falls apart? And that's a challenge I wanted to take it on and take really seriously. Or does it in fact show us and open up the possibility that the forms of power that we have been familiar with will continue in new forms on the basis of new infrastructures, because they need to continue, because they're very close to underlying power structures? So that's the second option on which, not surprisingly, I'm going to lay my bets. But it also brings together my latest take on my work, early work on media rituals, mediatization debates, the debate about whether digital media leads to a democratization of society, which I'm deeply skeptical about, some work on ethics. In other words, it's my shopping bag of my latest versions of the products I've been working on for the past 15 years, and I hope it will draw to an end as sort of phase of work for me. So that's what
interesting.
That
and that's
about.
Exciting. And I should say the audience here in this magnificent Catalan city was sizable and fulsome and energetic in its response. Well, Nick, you mentioned a little bit of your dark past as well as your light past, as it were, there, and how this is the culmination of many years of work. I wondered if I could take you back, as the cricket commentators say, when Jon Snow is running around the boundary trying to catch a hook at long leg. A reference that many listeners will get, especially the two men and a monkey in Lund, who are my regular correspondents.
Oh, right. Good.
And like me, you had a slightly erratic, non-teleological arrival into academia. I wonder if you could share a little bit about what happened to you kind of after university.
Yeah.
But also whether any of that feeds its way at all into how you go about your life as an academic.
Okay. Well, I guess my academic career, you know, if you looked at it drawn as a line in the floor, is more like an alcoholic snaking around a dance floor and never quite getting to the destination.
Which will be us in about 3 hours.
Exactly. Basically, my history is, in a sense, I was like a scholarship boy, or a Raymond Williams style, not slightly higher class position as Raymond Williams. My parents were lower middle class, but right. I was the first person to get into university, went to Oxford, did classics. Classics is... had a slight technical glitch there, but we recovered from that. Classics is the passport, really, to personal class transformation. Mm. Did classics at Oxford, did philosophy as well. Was really keen to be an academic, but had no idea as what, in what subject. Was pretty sure that classics was not the right subject. Do you think we're still recording okay?
Yeah, I think so.
And out of inertia, following my father, became a lawyer with deep misgiving.
So was Dad a lawyer without having gone to university?
He had a complicated history. He had been a political activist, but ended up second half of being a lawyer.
Because US listeners may not know that you can become a lawyer.
Yeah.
Well, actually, in the US, you can sort of do it too.
You can become it in a sort of lower status, which is what my father was. Yeah, well, anyway, right. I fully qualified to be a lawyer, which was his dream, absolutely not my dream.
Right.
And did that for a while, but very soon after I qualified, realized that this was not for me, and also discovered through music, which I used to do in the evenings in my suit or whatever, that actually there were totally different ways of being me. Which were just as convincing, in fact, a lot more convincing. And it took about 7 or 8 years for that to unravel. So I was a sort of academic or proto-academic who read New Left Review in the evening while doing something completely contradictory with everything that New Left Review was about during the day. And I survived this contradictory existence till about 92-93, gave up the law, did a master's at Goldsmiths, and kept the music going for the first 3 or 4 years, but once my PhD at Goldsmiths had taken off, I stayed with that. So really for me, my re-entry to the academic world came out of discovering the courses that David Morley and James Curran were teaching in the first year of Masters at Goldsmiths in 94, which seemed pretty obviously to me rich enough to keep you going for the rest of your life, and luckily it's proved that way.
That is a wonderful story, an absolutely inspiring story, because you followed somebody else's dream, your father's, realized that that wasn't quite for you, but did other things without jeopardizing that world, and then through those other things broke it away into a future for yourself. What was it about those courses that gave you this sense of a life path?
I think... I was already doing some writing around music, writing about the music I was involved in, which was a sort of improvised music that had a strong idea, a countercultural left perspective to it. But also I'd started to write a little bit about art and be involved in some art curating. So I was starting to get the hang of writing. So that was already growing. But James's course was so rigorous and so organized and so disciplined in its mastery of a field. That impressed me. And then more richly, in a way, because I'm in a sense an audience researcher, not an institutional researcher, Dave's course really, and it still does today, opened up a whole world of how you could draw on every social science, the whole of anthropology, the whole of sociology, political theory, to illumine these apparently simple things we do with these things we call media tests.
Yes. And I guess that's what's fascinating for a lot of people who follow the story at Goldsmiths from the outside, that you think of there being these two rather distinct approaches that James and Dave represent. As you say, James being a bit more about institutions, Dave being a bit more about audiences, but in fact they're both much more than that would suggest. But there's no real divide that means you can't combine these things and benefit from both of them.
And what unites both of them, even though they're always inflected in different ways, is they're both absolutely obsessed with going deeper and deeper in understanding the nature of media power and its complexity, and utterly impatient with traditional social science or traditional history's failure to come to terms with media power. So I guess, without question, the reason, if you like, that I both write on cultural studies and media research is that at Goldsmiths it seemed natural to do both. There simply wasn't a natural separation.
Natural separation.
Even though there might be some arguments about the dividing line. And that still forms me today, even though I've taken some things in different directions.
So you then did the PhD.
I did the PhD under Dave Morley.
Under Dave Morley. And what was the subject matter?
Well, I didn't have a clue, really, what the subject should be, and I was a most unconventional PhD student. So thank God for Dave in allowing me just to explore. So I spent the first term reading about media and space, but really about space.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, I was particularly interested in the idea that we needed to get away from studying media as texts and think about media as a dispersed force or lattice that really spreads across space and changes mm-hmm. the way that social is through its distributions and its embedding. And spatial theory was the best place to go with that. And that led to a theory which was about encounters with media power as a spatial phenomenon. Either the encounter that happens when people go to a site of media pilgrimage, why do they go to the set of Coronation Street when they can see it, they can read the text, put in heavy scare quotes. Well, they go because it's a site where power is concentrated and revealed and made manifest.
And Coronation Street, by the way, is a British soap opera, kind of early evening, late art soap opera that's been going for 50 years.
50 years. It had its anniversary recently.
And it's still phenomenally popular.
Sadly, you can't go to the set anymore because I think everyone who wanted to go to the set has now been about five times and that therefore became a no longer commercial deal. But I also was very interested from the beginning, and I think this is important to explaining how I approach media research. Interested in studying those people who are trying to contest media power, who were close to the site of media power because they had something to say, but they were not in the media. They had no privileged line to make doing interviews or no context in the press, but were protesting at a particular site where the cameras were very close. And they started to realize that when the cameras did not come unto them, that was the way media worked. Media was a spatial phenomenon. And they started to understand media is not an abstraction. It is a materially based process of power, which excludes at the same time as it includes. And so that was the way I got started. But I guess the key thing for me in all my work, which maybe gives people into how it holds together, is that I'm most, above all, interested in the distinctive nature of symbolic power. And here I'm not original, I'm drawing on Bourdieu's work, which itself is rooted back in Durkheim, really. The idea that when you concentrate the powers of symbolic production as opposed to economic production or military force, because they are powers of representation, they have a special capacity to disguise their workings. They work in such a way that we cannot see them at work unless we do deconstructive work on them. And therefore, they have a special type of force, which is to get merged into the world. That's not to say that weapons can't be hidden in the countryside, as they were very successfully at Greenham Common for quite some time until women went there. But nonetheless, this is intrinsic to the nature of symbolic power, this disguising of its force. But I wanted to combine that with, if you like, more recent understandings of power from Foucault, Latour, and so on, and also Bourdieu too, to look at how power works across space. It saturates space, it's never simply gathered in one place. And also that it works through networks. The power, let's say, of an institution like the BBC is built up over time by a whole series of networks being stacked upon each other, so much so that they appear to be the way the world is, the nature of British society. So one needs both types of understanding to get at the way, and this is the other thing that was important to me, the way that political economy structures take cultural effects. They come to have cultural roots because we internalize them, we get used to them, we live out their power effects daily when we do switch on the television, when we do pick up the newspaper and so on. So in a way then the challenge for me was to take that approach, which led to my work on reality television, media rituals, pilgrimages, celebrity on the one hand, and then alternative media on the other. And around about 2006-07, to start to think how that approach needed to be rethought or rephrased, perhaps at all, reformulated in relation to the digital media era. Did it depend on the assumption that media institutions and symbolic resources really were physically concentrated in just one type of place, the BBC, NBC, whatever. Or could it work just as well in the new digital era where outputs are proliferating, where all of us can in some sense be a media producer, where all audiences in a much more dispersed way were saturated? Can it still be possible for this very dispersed view of media power to work in this way? And I genuinely wanted to think about whether I needed to start over in the digital media era. And in the end, I came to the conclusion that actually, media power, if we take the example of celebrity culture, works just as well, if not better, in the in the digital media era, because it has so many more means of linking itself up, embedding itself in our daily lives, and drawing us back so we continue to pay attention.
So, in terms of going about these things, could you give us some tips on methods, what this actually entails? You know, when you know that you're encountering power, when you know that something is a symbolic resource?
Well, it's a difficult area, clearly, and it's not easy to track down this type of rather subtle form of power for the reasons I just mentioned. So I think a key tool, and for some people this is very old-fashioned, but I think Durkheim had a really fundamental insight in the late 19th, early 20th century, is the notion of the category. We remember that in Durkheim and Mauss and Mary Douglas as used to support some notion of a totalizing society, where all the categories link up into a total system. But that's not the only way to use the concept of the category. The category, for Durkheim, is a way of demarcating difference that is embedded enough in the world that we don't notice it anymore, and yet it remains absolute. Sacred versus profane being the key distinction, but there are so many others, and I tried to apply that to things like celebrity versus non-celebrity, media person versus non-media person, place in the media, which is magical, exciting, and so on, versus everything else, which is the way things are all the time. So one has to look at how categories work, but they don't just work in a mentalistic way through us absorbing them. And this is the problem with the older notion of ideology. Clearly, that is not how categories work today, or perhaps ever worked. It works through being embodied in practice, the way that when a celebrity enters the room, we all probably, regardless of our views of the basis or nature of celebrity, whether it's justified or whether it's an imposition and so on, we turn our heads. We look, we say, oh my God, and so on. We act out difference in a way, as Bourdieu says at one point, below the level of ideology, but at the level of the body, but the conscious body, not the absolutely unconscious body. And that's important. And I think celebrity practice is a particularly good example of how we're doing this all the time, but it's so banal we don't notice it. We have to notice it a lot more carefully.
Yesterday, I was on the plane with David Hasselhoff, who was the star of Knight Rider, an early 80s TV show, wasn't it? And who became a major singing star in Germany, certainly, and I think was one of the judges on Britain's Got Talent.
Anything's possible, yeah.
And the women sitting around me, he was only about 6 inches away from us, started talking instantly about him. I didn't recognize him at first, and then they said, the Hoff, in slightly hushed tones. One was Scottish, one was from the United States. And then the entire thing became about whether or not the woman with him was a daughter or a girlfriend, and then his clothing and all the rest of it. I got quite embarrassed because he was so close to us at the same time as I became similarly fixated. And at the end of the plane ride, all I wanted to do, more than get off the plane, was establish whether or not he really was wearing pink moccasins.
This is what Levi-Strauss called the narcissism of small differences. It matters because it's him. It's his body. He's a special type of body. Now, I think it's important to bring out that I'm not arguing that we're totally mystified by celebrity. We're all able to deconstruct it, but that doesn't mean that we don't reproduce it in practice. And this is the one area, as I take from Lacanian theory, from Zizek. He says at one point in The Sublime Object of Ideology, it doesn't matter whether we're thinking or ironizing. The matter is, are we still doing it? Yeah. Ideology is a practice, it's a way of doing things, and more than that, a way of dividing up the space of practice so that some people go one way, others go another, and so on.
And some decouple from it, don't they? And that's interesting.
Some can decouple from it, and of course, irony is very important to replaying ritual. We're all familiar, whether we're believers or not, with the possibility of laughing at the back of church. The reason is that the power of the church ritual is so strong that it can support noises off. It can support counter stories while remaining intact.
Mm.
But you can only grasp that if you have a notion of the categories on which that is based, the notion of the prayer, the direction you face, and so on and so forth. So that's the way I go about looking at action, looking how action is ordered, and how action is ordered often through categories, through distinctions that we make in practice, not often as marked as the distinctions that Bourdieu talks about, that you hold the knife in the right hand, not the left hand. Because, of course, those relate to an early society where practices were less overlaid with countless other influences and countless other systems. But that doesn't mean to say that there aren't some pretty simple differences that we mark out. Just to give you one example that I mentioned in the Media Rituals book, when we were on holiday once in Scotland, we were above a cliff looking down to the sea, and it's quite common in Scotland to have graveyards by the sea because a lot of people die at sea, the place to mourn. And we saw another one. We thought, this is going to be very moving. We're going to descend to look at this real graveyard. When we got there, it turned out to be a film set, a leftover film set from Breaking the Waves by Lars von Trier. And it said so in the sign outside. A, we were furious. We were really angry at this playing with our emotions. But B, what really struck me, and that's why I took a photo for the book Media Rituals, was that it said, do not enter. So it said, do not enter the symbolic space of a film set that is no longer a film set, but you must continue to respect it as something that was a film set. And this, for me, was an example of how media power works, by enjoining us to continue to respect these differences, even though at another level we may be able to laugh at them, deconstruct them. And insofar as we do repeat them, and they organize our practice, that is one of the reasons why we continue to turn towards media institutions rather than live our lives a very different way.
But that invites for me the question, cui bono, who benefits, to whose good is this? In other words, are the media in this formulation a kind of single great block? Are they representatives, delegates of the state and or business? Are they part of a morphology of ideology? Who are the people and what are the economic, cultural, social interests that are served by our being, in a sense, both subjects and sometimes objects of media power?
Well, that's a very good question. And it goes to the heart of the difficulty of, but the necessity of trying to get exactly right how I'm framing this question of, if you like, ideology and media power, which is that there's no intent to create this type of. It's an emergent form that emerges as a sort of cultural epiphenomenon, if you like, that emerges over on top of a real structuring of resources, a real organization of ourselves in the historic period of mass media into audiences versus producers and so on. Now it's more complicated, but there are still divisions. Out of that emerge practices, ways of living with that, cultural ways of stabilizing that, which are not fully planned, but once they become, have a certain momentum, all sorts of other cultural practices with their own meaning build around them, stabilize around them. And now, what's interesting, I'll give you an example of this, is that in the past 20 years, we saw, at first, for very good, clear reasons we all understood, the emergence of a phenomenon called reality media. We know why it emerged originally, because it was cheap TV that was able to fill airwaves with low risk, but potentially high success rates, and therefore fantastically good ratio of cost and benefits. But it stabilized. Many people within 5 years said it would disappear, but it stabilized. Now, you could give a sort of expressive explanation that people want to be recognized. They're not normally recognized. Reality TV provides that mechanism. But I think it's not just because of that. It's because this, along with celebrity culture generally, are a contingent, almost chance emergence that is in fact extraordinarily convenient for media institutions, because they go on justifying, without appearing to, the necessity, the rationale for paying attention to media. And when we think about, and this moves back to the digital era, when we think about the strains now on media corporations, the profound uncertainty about their economic models. What are media? How can advertising be sustained? How can anything as large and resource-rich as a media institution actually be sustained from the economic sources that are currently available, leaving aside state subsidy? Then the confusion about what media are. How can people's practice, is it ever going to stabilize around one way of using the iPad and another, given that there's an effectively infinite plurality of possibilities? Are we going to know what using the media is in 15 years' time? These really deep problems of, if you like, media ontology hit home because they make a difference whether there are jobs in the media industries or not. And I will want to suggest that what I call the myth of the mediated center, the fiction that media are the whole mass of institutions around which we need to pay attention if we're to follow what's going on for us as a notional society, that myth is very important and it is sustained in countless ways. Now, just want to bring out one point. The myth is a myth that media is one thing, that there is the media. There is no such thing. It's just an endless range, an assemblage of institutions and networks and resources and objects and so on. But the myth is very important to convincing that it's otherwise, that there is something that coheres in some level. We may no longer believe in a simple myth of the media, the mass media, but the idea that there aren't connections, there isn't something, a tissue that links up celebrity culture, so it's something to be paid attention to. I mean, we can see this acted out every day when we pick up a magazine and it takes us to another story, takes us to a badge we're wearing, a perfume we've just bought, or buying for someone, and so on and so forth. So the final point I want to make is that this is not a monolithic view of power, but it is an attempt to give cultural specificity to how a deep concentration of power can be lived out as a reality. And so in effect, it's a cultural supplement to political economy. I don't do political economy at World Work itself, myself, because I'm actually, I think, better, more temporary and suited to study the outputs of media and what people do with them. Others, are, like you, are much better at studying institutions and their history than I would be. But nonetheless, in no way is my work opposed to political economy. It's the cultural supplement that political economy needs to really stick in the world and become a way of life.
I wanted to ask you two things, if I could, Nick. The first is, following up on your remark about categories and your use of Durkheim, one of the most important adoptions of Durkheim comes from Harold Garfinkel's ethnomethodology, and a research paradigm that's all too little used in media studies, but has been used, of course, and you're very aware of it. I'm fascinated by the way in which, in a kind of Wittgensteinian nominalist way, sociological categories for ethnomethodology are literally those that are used every day by ordinary people. So they're not these superordinate forms of typologization that a bunch of men and women with lots of letters after their names create. They are actually the making do in the world on an everyday basis. So I wondered if you could comment on that and indicate whether you think there's an interesting future for us in media and cultural studies, perhaps revisiting ethno, because as you're aware, in the early days of British cultural studies, they were actually quite connected, and then they disarticulated.
That's a really good question. I mean, Garfinkel was a great inspiration for me. When I was trying to think about how, as you just asked the question of methodology, how could I go into a dense, saturated situation where I thought media power was somewhere in the room and draw it up to the surface. It was reading Garfinkel's studies in ethnomethodology that gave me the clue that what you do somehow is encourage or find being encouraged a situation of estrangement. And for me, that's why I wanted to study people who physically come close up to power. They do see the celebrity and see they're not as tall as they thought and so on. Or they do see the set and realize that actually, if you walk 1 meter to the left, there's nothing there and so on. Because under those situations, the deeper assumptions that lie behind the notions of power get articulated. And that's what I found in the fieldwork. So ethnomethodology, absolutely right, remains a fundamental inspiration because it gets at how field work can draw to the surface simply by, not distorting, but simply by encouraging situations or following situations where things get made explicit that aren't normally explicit. It's a way to get at power. However, there was always a problem with ethnomethodology, and Goffman, who I'm a great admirer of, there's a problem with this, which I think Bourdieu was right to spot, which is that it operated with a profoundly local notion of power. It's extremely difficult to go from a Goffman view of the situational encounter, like we're having now, where there's a certain power relation, certain boundaries, and so on, to a sense of political economy, the way CNN still makes a difference, or Al Jazeera does, and so on. And what I was interested in, how do you link the two? There has to be a linkage on the ground in terms of the way we reproduce assumptions, categories, and basic patterns of practice. We switch on. We don't do nothing when we get home. We switch something on. Or now we have the media permanently on as we go around in the world. We don't even need to switch it on. It's permanently on. So I was interested in making those links and not ditching the good things of ethno-methodology while still being able to move to the wider levels of power. But this leads me to one of the things I talked about this afternoon, which is that I think those writers in contemporary sociology, like Latour, Karen Norsatine, and so on, who were right, deeply inspired by Garfinkel, Goffman, that attempt to get beyond any crude micro-macro distinction, which is obviously right, because it just doesn't work. It's completely irrelevant to the type of power relations I've just been talking about. Nonetheless, I think there are two sorts of problems with that type of work as applied to media. I'll just talk about media. One is that actor network theory doesn't have a theory of representation. It talks about how descriptions of the world get built into networks and structures. But once the structures and networks have been built, if they produce representations, there is nothing in actor network theory to tell us what happens to those representations, because the notion of categories and representations deliberately was dropped from that model of social ontology on the basis that didn't really explain how structures were built, how power worked. They threw away too much, I think, and they threw away the bit that's absolutely crucial for understanding media, which is media institutions make representations. The other sort of problem that's emerge in that type of social theory is, if you like, a suspicion with any notion of social order at all. People, really fine and very smart social critics like Nigel Thrift, who's written great work in the past, been writing recently about non-representational theory. Now, if you look at that book, what's interesting is that although it says some quite expected things about how everything is unstable, how power is dispersed and so on, there's no micro and macro, there's no real sense of scale, the one thing it doesn't justify is the idea of non-representational theory. It just talks about media in terms of emotional affects in a Deleuzean style. And what I was arguing this afternoon is that this is a colossal mistake, and this is really disabling for any critical media research or critical cultural research or critical political engagement. The idea that representations do not occur and do not have consequences, even though we now know the consequences are pretty complicated in a highly dispersed society, the countless ways of getting to media, is a very dangerous cul-de-sac. And we need, and this was the point of my talk today, to emerge quickly from that cul-de-sac and get back to taking seriously the complexity of how representations still matter.
Sure. Well, I guess part of the thing is that there's a rejection of the notion of depth that you get in ethno-methods and also in Latour, that I think probably has generated this.
And some of what Latour did, and I'm a great admirer of Latour, is absolutely brilliant. His complicating of the notion of scale, his almost deconstruction of it. Latour and Callan's great essay, Unscrewing the Big Leviathan, from 1980, where they show that power can be both very physically centralized, but based around a whole dispersed network, and be real, but not in any way simple. And the idea of size of power is absolute. So this was a brilliant concept, and absolutely fundamental to how we understand media power. The BBC is not big, but it's dispersed, profoundly dispersed in British culture, so that you cannot be unpicked. You cannot take it out without untangling a whole host of other things. So there's a huge amount to learn from Latour, but I think some of the positions Latour has taken without recognition of media studies. It wasn't his main concern. Are really very unhelpful media studies, and we need to be honest about seeing that. And this leads to a wider question that I think for a long time media studies drew from certain social theory, particularly a Marxist direction, but others too, rather than being seen or even having the legitimacy in the academy of answering back and adding things to broader social theory. And that apartheid almost in the academy, that media studies is allowed to add footnotes and little insights, but not to fundamentally alter the structure of social theory, continues. And what I'm, my longest term ambition is to, in some way with others, to try and get to a situation where media can be taken seriously as a factor that changes social ontology, changes what there can be in the social world radically, and forces social theory to take account of that. And at the moment, that's not working, because what you get coming out of sociology is an engagement with media, with new software and other technologies, which actually is a sort of disguised technological determinism and simply does not engage with representation and therefore not with interpretation or use.
And also doesn't engage with existing literature. You see this with
absolutely
the
not.
Way in which literary studies started writing about film and then new technology in the communications area without considering what had been done in media and communication studies, the way in which television was simply leapfrogged and forgotten about, radio never engaged, the press never engaged. Any of these very established fields in the fancy part of the humanities and the social sciences simply assume that, you know, they have a magisterial mode that will be applied wherever and whenever.
And there were the two other problems. One, I think, is a really general one right across the humanities and social sciences, which is the big stick of philosophy. Mm. I did philosophy in my first degree. I love philosophy. I still draw on it. But it's a classic move and used again and again and again to bring on the big stick of the philosopher who can legislate for the world and say, this is broadly the way it is, without reference to any detail that might complicate the picture. From Baudrillard onwards, this has been dominating certain type of sociological reading of what media do, and it's problematic because it's not based in any empirical texture, any sense of the complexity. But there's another problem, because it might sound as if I'm constantly complaining about the others and not being honest about the faults within the field of media studies too, and cultural studies. I think there's also a danger in our field that of a certain type of fashion-driven attention to the latest developments, and there are so many of them, every possible direction in the media field, which makes it very difficult for us to get any analytic distance to the significance of the iPad or the latest social media platform and so on. And that's why we need tools of social theory to give us the chance of having some sort of distance.
Well, there's capture by the object, isn't there?
Yeah, there's
and
that.
You get this in very clearly in literary studies. You get this very clearly in film studies. And now you're getting it in television studies. I mean, if in all fields of endeavor we wrote about what we loved, you'd never find a way of fixing a broken leg or ameliorating the impact of a common cold.
No, that's right. And also, if you write about what the media hype is about, and that we can't, none of us would deny it, some of that, because we write about media, infects or infuses our own work, then you make a basic mistake, which is that habit, which I think is the most important structuring force in the social world, because we need stability in order to live at all, for our bodies to have environments in which we can survive. Habit is not news. Media do not talk about the fact that people are still watching TV. As you know, because you've written about it in your recent book, and I've written about too, and it's come out of surveys and other stuff we've done, television remains the dominant medium in pretty well every country. Newspapers remain important in some Scandinavian countries where youth reading of newspapers still continues. The idea that everything is changing in the media for all in one direction and in accordance with the dictates of the latest fashions is absolutely upside down. And therefore, as Marx would say, it's an ideology. And we have to step outside that ideology if we're to have any hope.
Methodological nationalism in all senses of the term. And we get this so much in the Anglo world. Obviously, it's horrendous in the United States, but it's pretty bad in the UK as well.
It is. And I, you know, as someone who's written in the UK, who is effectively monolingual, I can read French, read some Spanish, don't speak Spanish, I'm as guilty of anyone of often framing things, particularly in the Media Rituals book, from the point of view of Britain, America, and saying this is the theory for everyone. Clearly that's not acceptable. I think the book that's most changed my views was Marwan Crady's book, Reality TV and Contentious Politics, about the Arab world, because it head-on attacked that type of assumption and proved its absurdity for a part of the world where the geography, the scale, the political economy of media, the implications of a woman appearing to show part of her body or to speak in public are radically different from other parts of the world. What I'm hopeful about is that the moves which have been building for 5 or 10 years that Marwan and yourself are part of to genuinely internationalize media studies, and we could say cultural studies too, so that our theoretical tools, our framing of the questions is no longer determined by how it looks from one point, one very privileged point, but is genuinely open to total retooling, reframing, on the basis of what we learn from different parts of the world. That's this exciting phase we're entering at the moment. And for our particular field, I think that's probably the thing
that's
quite exciting, because social theory will not be to everyone's taste, it happens to be to mine. But the idea of an internationalizing agenda, I think, is increasingly dominating everyone's work. It's certainly dominating mine. And we need to think about it in a way that doesn't just say, well, let's get more types of insect and put them in a museum. You know, there are lots of different types of reality media and count them up. That's not internationalizing research. Internationalizing media research is thinking seriously about the range that's possible, given the range of institutional structures that underlie media and the different cultural phenomena, the range of reality media, or the range of ways that people use phones. Radically different if you're a Chinese migrant worker on $1 a day who's living 1,000 miles from your family, but you have to communicate. You use, of course, SMS, and you use certain types of internet chat and whatever. And I guess the other book that's influenced me most in the past 3 or 4 years is Jack Chu's book, Working Class Network Society. Coming out of a serious methodologically grounded approach, the Castells Network approach, but applying it in a radically new situation, Chinese migrant, internal migrants.
And with some real politics.
Real politics and micro attention to the detail and how it is on the ground if you are on $1 a day and your family's 1,000 miles away. And that points the way to a very different type of media studies that's rooted in attention to underlying human needs, the material basis on which we turn to media at all, rather than the rhetorics that say this is what people are doing. That seems to me the way forward. The challenges are different in Britain, but we can learn an awful lot from that type of study.
I said I had two questions, and I have another one I'd like to put to you. This comes from a potted world history that is questionable, but nevertheless, I just thought of it while we were chatting. If you have an account of modes of production that says there's some kind of movement from people engaging in subsistence life to manufacturing life and a shift from the rural to the urban, and that the media become part of that as increasingly you move to what's called a post-industrial world where it's not about subsistence nor about manufacturing, it's about, in a sense, paying other people to do that, and these societies becoming service or creative countries. This is a narrative you could tell about the United States, about most of Western Europe. It's the narrative the Chinese are trying to create for themselves in order to have a life after the idea of being the proletariat of the world, and when they want to be able to be lazy like white people and live from intellectual property. If that's a story one could tell, my potted history of the world in 25 seconds, are we coming round to another kind of life where we're actually entering, and I just thought of this term when I was listening to you, media subsistence. With all this capacity not to be an audience anymore, but to be supposedly a prosumer or a sitsumer, where the distinction between those who make and those who receive media is compromised, where the old-style world of family happy snappies projected onto the wall becomes part of ordinary life. Julia Lesage has coined this expression, handmade media, to refer to what you and I are doing now, where actually the media industries could collapse under the weight of all kinds of factors, but one of which is that we've become subsistence media subjects instead of workers and consumers.
Well, that is definitely possible. And that's the piece I wrote in 2009 called Does the Media Have a Future? Was designed to sort of make that a question, an explicit question for media studies. The very loose social institutions that media institutions are, which with all the rhetorical trappings that something like the BBC carries with, even though it's much smaller than you might believe from the rhetorical claims, they're under threat by the basic nature of the industry. They have to continue, but they may not succeed. So that led me to think, well, who else has a stake in them succeeding? Of course, governments do, for a start. Governments need to speak to populations, or at least they need to have a plausible pretense that the populations are listening to them when they speak. That's probably the basis of democracy. They don't actually want real engagement. They do. They need to be able to say, we are now speaking to the people. Similarly, corporations have to do this. This is the basis of advertising. This is the fundamental value production that underlies the possibility of advertising, the possibility of generating income from advertising, and so on and so forth. So all these things link together. But it's possible it could fall apart. Why would that happen? Well, I think, again, one of the most interesting books I'm giving you, my favourite books, is James from the past, is James Benish's book, The Crisis of Control. I'm not sure that was the exact title, but he talked about the crisis of control in the 19th century, where suddenly there wasn't enough information. When a train set down a line, it wasn't possible to say the train is going to be there at 3:30, so get off that line, otherwise you will die. As a result, there was a tremendous pressure very quickly when people died on the railway lines to transmit information, to do it in a way that it got there in time and in the right form. I think we can argue, and I've noticed that Rob Ling and Pedersen in their recent book on mobile phone make a similar type of argument, that we're in the opposite situation. We are in a crisis of control in relation to information, but it's not because there's too little information, because there's too much. There is simply an infinite plurality. It's not just an infinity, but there are many infinities of information. We don't know which one to choose from, and in any event, it's still infinite. We can't manage it, we can't grasp it, and yet it is the nature of the information economy, really. And, will people just walk away from this? Well, that, I think, is a question that Sherry Turkle's really interesting new book, Alone Together, raises. One may or may not take a different view of the rhetorical position she offers, but she does raise a serious ethical question about whether the media-saturated life that many of us now have is a life that we actually want. Does it have certain costs that could, in the long term, be too great? Could those costs leave us to stand back and say, I want a different type of life? And the conference we've been at, which is called Life Without Media, where you're speaking tomorrow, was a conference I really wanted to talk at, because it seemed to me, at least implicitly, with whatever intent, to be raising this question. I think Alberto Melucci, another political theorist I really admire, because he was the first political theorist to really think the symbolic matters, from the 80s onwards, says an interesting thing in one of his books, which he says that symbolic power saturates everywhere. And it is possible to fight back by turning symbols back on themselves, interpreting them differently, and so on. But he mentions quietly that there's one other way to resist power, which is to ignore me symbols, just to turn away, to opt out. I think in media studies, not surprisingly, given that we're doing media studies, we tend to ignore those who don't want anything to do with media. They exist. They may even be people who watch a lot, but hate it. One of the most interesting findings in the survey that Sonia Livingston and I did 4 or 5 years ago was those number of people, particularly of working class background in Britain, who, when asked, does media have anything to do with your life, in a fairly neutral way, said no. These were also the people that watch most television, the people who have fewest options to do anything else with their spare time. And I think the option of either standing back and finding other ways of living, or having no choice for doing that, but resenting this sense in the digital format that we have an infinite number of emails to cope with. We simply can't get away from this burden of over-communication. it's going to create new tensions, new ethical questions that I think in media studies we need to take on board and think about, because they go beyond ideology. They go to the sort of basic conditions of how we get through each day, whoever we are, whatever our
position. See, what I'm interested in is all those things, but also whether there could be such a radical decoupling of a kind we've gestured at a couple of times this afternoon, such that even, you know, in inverted commas, ordinary people without many cultural, economic, yeah, social resources could be so caught up, not people who are now our age and are working class, but people who are now 15 and are working class, are so technologically advanced and do have very good access to extremely cheap media making materials, and just say effectively fuck it.
I think that is, it's clearly a possibility. We're in Barcelona, which is one of the centres of the Indignados movement in Spain. The people have just left, last night, left the central square to disperse into different neighbourhoods. Now, they of course have a Facebook page. They've been sending images through Twitter and so on and so forth. They have a media presence, they're using digital media, but it hasn't built beyond the basic fact of presence, as far as I'm aware. It hasn't taken off into an alternative representation of the way Spain looks like, if you don't think you're ever going to get a job, but you do have social media. Mm. This could happen. Mm. It hasn't equally happened quite in Greece. There were signs of something stronger building in Egypt and so on. But I think the counterweight to that is that these very exciting developments happen under conditions of extreme need. Unless this condition of extreme need, and here we're getting into theories of capitalism, obviously, and revolution, unless these forms of extreme need become generalized, and in such a way that people recognize it is the same need they share with others, then there is a great risk that people, once the moment of need has passed, extreme need has passed, will lapse back into the normal habits. Habit, I think, is the key thing.
Habit.
And what would change that has to be some form of bigger context. Now, in the way you were saying, well, if people have got the tools anyway, they could just do it. They don't need a bigger context. But then media practices have always got to be meaningful. They've got to be a useful way of spending the time. And until people get the sense that their group, their network of friends, their network of people who have a view on the world that's different, is in some way valid, they won't spend their time that way. In the end, on a Saturday night, watching a film that's been made in Hollywood or Taiwan or wherever is going to be a better investment. Now, this links to the broader question of neoliberalism, which has been bubbling away in the soup we've been making for the past hour. That neoliberalism is an attempt in cultural form to install, as an absolute rule of practice, market logics, market values. It could change. It could collapse. It can only collapse if we build alternative values, which validate people, which recognize people's capacities to build, to contribute to social change. It is only that bigger political change, I think, that would make possible the type of reconfiguration of media practice, media resources, in the way that it remains technically possible. So we're now in a fascinating situation where all of us, anyone who looks at contemporary media, knows that a totally different social configuration is possible based on this media platform, in a way that it wasn't when you just had the BBC and the ITV in Britain, or the US prime time or whatever.
And a box brownie.
Yeah, a totally different social configuration could now work around this media infrastructure. But there has to be political conditions, economic conditions and forms of hidden forms of subsidy enable people to have the time to do all this, and there have to be cultural contexts that enable these practices to be validated, rather than the type of consumerist culture that is still extraordinarily powerful, and the broader neoliberal frame which devalues what we're talking about, or only values it on condition that it turns back into the consumer mainstream, and your Facebook work is also shows an interest in what's coming out of the latest celebrity.
So I got my video up on YouTube, it got the following number of viewings, as opposed to I've engaged in a wide-scale polyphonic conversation with people about the political, economic, cultural acts that I embarked on in the text.
Yeah. What we're looking at, in a way, is we've got a technological configuration which is consistent with a totally different social imaginary. I like Charles Taylor's phrase. But there's an awful lot of other forces pulling out away from that social imaginary, making it extraordinarily difficult to bring together. And maybe that's one of the things we can gradually try and articulate in media and cultural studies, which we haven't talked so much
that's
about.
Right. Well, one of the things I heard you saying today, and again this afternoon, Nick, is that on the one hand, you want to make media studies much less media-centric. You want it to be an area that is capable of and prepared to be looking at much broader social trends. And Arvind Rajagopal is somebody, as an example of somebody who tries to do that. Nestor Garcia Canclini would be another. And I think the same applies to your view of culture. Obviously, cultural studies is a little less focused and a little less reductive. But on the other hand, you want these broader Olympian areas, like sociology and philosophy, to be suffused with an appreciation of the importance of media. So you want the media folks to be less media-centric, and you want the other folks to be more media-centric.
Not more media-centric in the second case. More media-aware.
Media-aware.
So I think being media-aware is not being media-centric. It's, and the paradox is that sociology, classic sociology, starts to become media-aware, becomes media-centric in a bizarre way, in that it's technology-centric. It talks about the hard stuff, the stuff you can't argue with. It's there, it's installed. Everyone's plugged in. But that's, of course, misses the whole zone of the cultural, which is informed media studies, or the best media studies, from the very beginning. This is a culture, this is a fabric that is built through everyone's interaction, powerful or not. So yes, there is a bit of a paradox. I'm obsessed with trying to grasp the difference that media do make to the social world, the possibility of a social world. But I think you can only grasp that if you understand there's a lot more in the social world than media. And our draw towards media is itself linked to much deeper forces and much deeper needs than just those of the media industry.
If you think about our shared love, passion for cricket, amongst many other things, C.L.R. James had that wonderful expression, didn't he, the great Marxist post-colonial critic, editor, and in fact novelist and historian, about those who only cricket know do not know about cricket. Whilst not having to make it necessarily absolutely reflective of the social order, it is at least in part indexical of it. In the same way that Ashish Nandi, the great Indian psychologist, sociocultural theorist, talks about the Indian invention of cricket, that you think of it not as being simply an imposition as part of being an imperial possession, but rather as something that people, in fact, reconfigure with their own resources. And now, in the case of cricket, worldwide, it is essentially run by Indian financial interests.
And it's becoming a very different phenomenon, with partly different rituals, different symbolic architecture linked to it, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And you can't get at that through a narrow media studies.
No, you can't. And as you say, and I think this is the message, or what they like to call in American business talk, the takeaway.
Takeaway, yeah.
Well, the take home.
Or the take home, perhaps.
Take home.
The take home.
Yeah, I'm always thinking of food.
The takeaway is quite right.
When it gets to around 8 o'clock, I'm beginning to think about take home.
Takeaway point.
Is that, you know, you need to have, you need to muddy the picture of a separation of base and superstructure, both in terms of the relationship of the social to the mediatic and the relationship of the mediatic to the social. That both these domains, to the extent that they can be separated, have elements that are, if you like, superstructural and substructural, and that you need to know both of them, and one does not necessarily reflect the other. There are all kinds of bases that you can put on a building. It doesn't mean that the building looks the same once it's been constructed in its totality.
That's a good way of summing it up, and I think summing it up, they brings out the Marxist perspective in terms of looking at the material basis of power, and also, of course, the Foucauldian perspective, are fundamental. But it's writers like Lefebvre who were really alive to the contradictions of everyday life, the way that although this is our only site of freedom, nonetheless it's saturated with power and it cannot be understood unless we grasp that.
Beautifully put. Nick Caldrey, thank you very much.
Thank you, it's been a pleasure.
One simple request. When book number 10, is it, we were told today, comes out, will you please re-enter the pod and tell us more about it?
I will. I'd love to.
Many thanks.
Thanks, Toby.